you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at laist.com/sweeps.
KPCC supporters include Freeform's The Bold Type, produced by Universal Television. Emmy eligible in all categories, including Outstanding Drama Series. Episodes available at freeform.com, the Freeform app, and Hulu.
This is Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Such a pleasure to have you with us. Got some really good movies to talk about this week. That's the early word from our critics, Christy Lemire and Justin Chang. Christy can be seen at RogerEbert.com with her reviews. She's co-host of YouTube's What the Flick, and Justin Chang, Los Angeles Times film critic. We begin with Ocean's 8. The heist film, this time with an all-star, all-women cast, led by Sandra Bullock and Cate Blanchett, with Anne Hathaway, Mindy Kaling, Sarah Paulson, Awkwafina, and many others. Gary Ross directs and co-wrote the screenplay with Olivia Milch. Christy, what'd you think?
This movie is just a straight-up blast. And in a summer where we have so many big, bloated superhero comic book blockbusters, these are your true Avengers. Sandra Bullock stars as Debbie Ocean. She is the estranged sister of George Clooney's Danny Ocean from the previous Ocean's trilogy. And like him, she's just a straight up criminal. And when we see her at the beginning of the film, she is talking her way out of prison after 5+ years at the parole board hearing. And she's got a plan. She goes back to New York and she assembles a crew and she wants to hold up the Met Gala, the annual fashion extravaganza, the most glittering night of the year, celebrities and incredible gowns. And there's a particular necklace that she wants to steal from the neck of a particular starlet at that event.
Well, I'm thinking the sight gags alone have to be great, because the event itself is so over the top and tongue-in-cheek.
It is, and they have fun with that, but also, you know, the clothes are to die for, and so you have this fantastic array of actresses. Besides Sandra Bullock, Cate Blanchett plays her longtime partner who she coerces back into it. Sarah Paulson and Helena Bonham Carter and Awkwafina, who was just a blast, and it's an amazing cast, and it's fun, but it's also trying to say something. There's a very sly comment in here about the world in which we live, because Sandra Bullock, Debbie, explains the reason they can pull this off in plain sight is because a him gets noticed, a her gets ignored, and this time we want to be ignored. And so they're able to pull it off in the middle of it because no one expects that they're going to do it.
Who thinks women are going to pull off a heist
right
like this?
Anyway, it's a lot of fun and the clothes are great. And like serious designers contributed the gowns for these women on this night, from Dolce & Gabbana to Valentino to Prada. So if you can go just for the glitz and the escape of it, but it's trying to say something too.
Justin, yeah, what do you think?
Absolutely, you know, a political dimension to this movie. I think a trend we're seeing of, you know, Hollywood properties, beloved Hollywood properties, being outfitted with all female casts. You know, we had this with Ghostbusters a couple, you know, not too long ago. And with this one, this is a better movie than Ghostbusters, I think. And it mostly works. I wanted a little bit more just visual pizzazz from it. I think the director, Gary Ross, does a perfectly serviceable job, but he isn't Steven Soderbergh. And it's interesting because I think this script, this material, is actually a little bit better, more kind of better carpentered than, say, Ocean's 12 or Ocean's 13 even. But what Soderbergh kind of brought to that was this incredible just stylistic flair. It was almost like verging on abstract, just the color and the kineticism. And here, it's a little more workmanlike, and it's fine. And it's interesting because on another level, it's sort of puts the focus, I guess it's like it's up to the actresses to provide, and the costumes, you know, to provide that glamour. But I just wish it feels a little workmanlike in the way it's directed. But
it moves really well, though. It glides. It's glitzy. It is a little thin, as you say. There are a lot of actresses here whose characters I would like to have seen fleshed out better, including Mindy Kaling, including Rihanna, including Sarah Paulson, for sure. But Anne Hathaway is your MVP here. She is so funny. She is the starlet who becomes the unwitting eighth co-conspirator here.
She's the mark.
Yeah. And she doesn't even know anything that's going on, but she's like a preening diva at times and then just this fragile little girl at others. And it's a hilarious performance. She's so great in this.
It's also kind of the movie is sort of a stealth sequel or rejoinder to The Devil Wears Prada, because she is playing the exact opposite of the kind of the fashion novice that she played in that movie. Here she's, you know, the picture of privileged spoiled celebrity. And to underscore the connection, you know, Anna Wintour, Vogue editor and chair of the Met Gala, has a bit of a cameo in this.
Yes, a lot of celebrities here. Heidi Klum has a funny little bit. It's a blast. Go see it.
Ocean's 8, starring Sandra Bullock and Cate Blanchett. Gary Ross directed and co-wrote the screenplay with Olivia Milch, rated PG-13. The horror film Hereditary stars Toni Collette, Alex Wolff and Millie Shapiro. Ari Aster is the writer-director. It's a feature directorial debut. Justin?
I love this movie. This is I've been waiting for this movie to open over the past few months. I saw it at a midnight screening at Sundance. It was the last one I saw there. It was just one of the most memorable Sundance experiences I've had in years. And now it is here. This is a really incredibly upsetting horror film. I think it's absolutely terrifying, but it's nowhere near as terrifying as it is just emotionally devastating. A real emotional workout. Remarkable first time. Writing directing debut by Ari Aster, who's prodigiously talented, and it features one of the year's great performances. I'll say that now, even though it's only June, by Toni Collette, who gives a performance as she plays this woman named Annie, who's an artist and a wife and a mother of two, who has just lost her own mother. They had a very difficult, estranged relationship, and you feel as the days after the funeral, this weird hold that it's almost as if, you know, Something is not right with their family history, and it is very much weighing on the present. She has two kids, one played by Millie Shapiro, who is this almost comically creepy younger kid who, just the way she's dressed, the way she's shot, the way she, you know, likes to, you know, cut the heads off birds. You know, there's just something is not quite right with this child. And then she has an older teenage brother played by Alex Wolff, who's really, really good as this sort of, you know, kind of traditionally disaffected, teen who's, who's moody and inattentive. I don't want to say too much more than that. If you know that, it's plenty. But what happens in this movie is so just breathtakingly unexpected and so just merciless and unsparing emotionally. And yet it's done with this. What gives it such impact is just the deliberation of Ari Aster's style, the way he, you know, plants details in every frame. The filmmaking, watch this film. It's a movie that you will watch through your fingers at a certain point, you know, covering your eyes. But I urge you to keep your eyes as open as possible, because there is so much going on in every frame.
What a debut you're describing for Aster. What did you think of Hereditary?
Yeah, it's a stunningly assured debut. And I'm with Justin that it didn't frighten me. Like, it's not a scary, shocking, gory horror movie, really. It's more just deeply upsetting and deeply unsettling and disturbing. And it's so meticulously crafted. From the first opening shot alone, this long tracking shot, you know you are in the hands of a master and somebody who has really thought through every single detail. I echo what Justin says about seeing it in a theater, see it on the biggest screen you can find. Also, if you can find the best possible sound, the sound design here is exquisite. And the score from composer Colin Stetson is kind of avant-garde, kind of jazzy, and it very much plays into the sense of hallucinatory dread. And you don't know what is real and what is not. Toni Collette, give her all the awards now. I mean, she's been phenomenal for decades, but this is a big, showy role that also has great, deep emotional truth to it. I know horror does not often get awards, but this one should.
Well, I was going to say, the way you're describing this, this sounds like a Best Picture contender.
I can imagine that very easily, especially in the world in which we live now, where you have 10 possible slots for that.
Maybe. I will believe it when I see it. That would be amazing.
It'd be amazing.
But it is interesting, because this movie really does kind of merge, you know, horror with domestic tragedy. I mean, there are times, there are moments here that kind of are worthy of like an Ingmar Bergman movie or a John Cassavetes movie, you know. And there's also, it also is very much conversant with, you know, Rosemary's Baby and The Exorcist and The Shining in terms of just the sheer level of craft.
Speaking
that it
brings of to it. A very frightening film.
It's also like an evil Wes Anderson movie, though. Because there's like dollhouses and dioramas and the attention to detail is like
stunning.
Perfect and minute. Yes, please go see it.
Charles would say that's redundant. Hereditary is rated R. It's in wide release. Ari Aster, the writer-director. It stars Toni Collette. Hotel Artemis, a futuristic sci-fi film, is written and directed by Drew Pearce, and Drew makes his directorial debut. Christy?
So this has also a very specific sense of time and place. And it takes place in a futuristic Los Angeles 10 years from now. It is the dystopian future. It's coming in 10 years, guys.
So a lot happens fast.
Water's going to be privatized, and all of Los Angeles is just being torn apart by violence, apparently. And in the midst of this is this place called the Hotel Artemis. It is actually a hospital for criminals who can afford to have a very exclusive membership that they can enjoy when they get shot, when they get stabbed, when they just need to hide from whoever is coming after them. They can go there, and they are named based on the rooms in the hotel that they are staying in. So maybe they are Acapulco or they are Waikiki. And the cast is really eclectic. It's like Jodie Foster, first of all, plays the nurse who runs the place. And it's this weird, funny, beautifully strange, detailed, jittery performance. And I love it. And Dave Bautista is her right-hand man who, you know, he is Drax in the Guardians movies. He's great here, too.
Jeff Goldblum
shows up and is just awesomely weird, as Jeff Goldblum tends to be. But also you have people in here that you don't necessarily see in a big sci-fi thriller, like Jenny Slate, like Charlie Day. And the production...
Starring Kay Brown.
Production design is really cool because it's got like the vintage LA Art Deco details, but there's also a futuristic kind of high-tech element. But in the middle of it, there's this grungy 70s grime to everything. Anyway, it's stylish for days. I don't know if there's a whole lot to it from a substance perspective, but it's cool to look at.
I think there are could be a lot more to this movie because I love the premise of it, and it bears some resemblance to like the John Wick movies, where there are this hotel where the rules are you can't kill anyone, and the rule is here applies here too, you can't kill anyone. So I feel like there could be like I'd want to watch Hotel Artemis like the miniseries or something, or even a whole season. But I think that they don't, you know, they have a really interesting premise, but they don't really capitalize on it story wise, and it's over before it's really gotten a chance to realize its full potential.
Hotel Artemis, the near future Los Angeles depicted in the wide release. It's written and directed by Drew Pearce and rated R. Won't You Be My Neighbor, a documentary about the late Fred Rogers and Mr. Rogers' neighborhood, directed by Morgan Neville. Justin?
You will probably cry during this movie. This is kind of the documentary that the Mr. Rogers doc that has been reducing audiences to tears. But it's interesting. It's a question of when you will. I mean, for some people, it would just the minute the movie opens with these, you know, it will stir your nostalgia if you grew up watching Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. I wasn't a religious viewer of it myself, but I certainly, you know, did, you know, my parents did show it to me on occasion. The minute when you see him, you know, putting on the cardigan and taking off his loafers, and it's like it stirs something in you. But I think what's so moving about this movie is it reminds me of something Roger Ebert used to say, which has always stayed with me. It's like he said he's more moved by goodness than by sadness. And here you have what appears to be a figure of just unalloyed goodness. This movie isn't the most I remember reading an interview with the director. It's like, I hope you didn't find like dig up like, you know, he had like 60 illegitimate children or something. You know, it's like it's not an expose.
No.
It doesn't, you know, you kind of get glimmers of, you know, his own childhood dealing with bullying and dealing with his own insecurities. But it isn't the kind of really, you know, like offering like multiple perspectives on it's just a portrait of him and his legacy, which was to bring this immense class and dignity and kindness to televisions and the pioneering strides he made in children's programming, where it was about really having a relationship with each and every one of his childlike viewers, his child viewers.
I'll tell you when I cried in this movie. I cried, again, at a couple of examples of his kindness to reaching out to people who had been shunned for whatever reason, based on sexual orientation or disability. He had a heart that was open for everyone. No, this is not in any way a warts and all depiction of him, but there is such love, and you realize how everything he did in this show made no sense in terms of what you would want in a popular television show. You know, it was low key and rough hewn and kind of cheesy and corny.
I love the moment where he just like, let's watch an egg timer and see how long a minute takes. And he just like playing with time as well.
I love that.
It's from the director of 20 Feet from Stardom, by the way. He won an Oscar, same director. And it's great. It'll make you cry for sure.
Speaking of which, Morgan Neville, the director of the film, was joined by John Horn of The Frame. They did an interview, and you can hear that at kpcc.org/The Frame. Neville is not just a terrific filmmaker. He's a great talker, and I'm looking forward to hearing that interview. Won't you be my neighbor? Documentary on Fred Rogers and Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. It's at the Arclight Hollywood and the Landmark. It's rated PG-13. That's a little bit of a surprise. should be good to see the life of Fred Rogers on screen. Coming up, we'll talk about the thriller Nancy and the Australian drama Breath. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Such a pleasure to have you with us. In case you joined us late, I want to remind you the podcast is always available for your listening. Wherever you get your podcast, whatever app you use, it's there. And we encourage you to listen whenever you miss the regular broadcast of the show. Next up is Nancy, a thriller that stars Andrea Riseborough, Steve Buscemi, and Ann Dowd. Christina Cho, feature directorial debut. That's the theme of the week. She's the writer and director. Justin, what'd you think?
I think this is a good debut. In a good film. Andrea Riseborough gives a very good but almost boldly kind of alienating performance as the title character, Nancy, who is an aspiring writer and, as it turns out, early on in the movie, a pathological liar. She likes to invent stories. She likes, you know, and she lives in this, you know, unspecified but kind of wintry northeastern town. Life is very dreary. She's looking after her mother, played by Ann Dowd, who's also in Hereditary, by the way. Ann Dowd is the star of the moment. She has Parkinson's, the mother does, and Nancy has a really miserable job at a dental office. So her life is just going nowhere, and this is the only life she's known. And what this movie is kind of showing her testing the imaginative limits of her world and trying to find, you know, by lying, by telling, for example, meeting an online date and saying that she's pregnant and, you know, wearing something underneath her coat, You're constantly wondering what makes her tick. Why is she doing this? And what's bold about Riseborough's performance is that it doesn't tell you really clearly. She's got a kind of this listless, flat, affectless demeanor. She's really kind of doesn't seem terribly bright, but at the same time, she's imaginative enough to come up with these lies. And then what happens is she sees on TV this couple played by J. Smith Cameron and Steve Buscemi, who give wonderful performances. They lost their daughter 30 years ago when she was 5, about the same age as Nancy, and there's a striking physical resemblance to them. And she calls them up and says, I think I'm your daughter.
Wow.
It's a very daring movie because Nancy is kind of sick and kind of predatory, and the movie eventually doesn't necessarily ask you to sympathize with her, but at least come to understand or at least care about her. And the performance is so subtle, and the tension really builds in a slow burn kind of way, and you do wonder until the very end, okay, what's true and what's not, and is she tricking them, or does she truly believe this time? It's a great rich sense of place in a very bleak part of the country. Yeah, I liked it, but I felt uneasy coming out of it.
Nancy is the film. It's at the New Art Theater in West LA. It's unrated, written and directed by Christina Choi, and a feature directorial debut. Breath is an Australian drama starring Elizabeth Debicki, Simon Baker, and Richard Roxburgh. Simon Baker is the director of the film as well as one of the stars, and he co-wrote the screenplay with Gerard Lee. Justin?
Yeah, another directorial debut. This one by a very well-known actor, Simon Baker, who plays in the movie as well. He plays this guy named Sando, who is a champion surfer, and he takes these two young, you know, lads under his wing in this West Australian coastal town. This is a really lovely, very familiar. It's definitely not, you know, carving any new pathways through the surf movie genre, but it does have kind of an interesting flavor because of the setting. You know, it's instead of, you know, kind of California sunshine, you get this very gray, overcast setting. Really beautiful, lovely surf footage. It's about the kind of push-pull of the relationship between Simon Baker's character and the two young boys, one of whom is the proper protagonist, and he's actually voiced by the Australian writer Tim Winton, who wrote the novel on which this is based. So he's kind of, you know, Tim Winton is narrating the movie kind of in retrospect. So it's, you know, there's romantic elements, there's betrayal, there is, you know, kind of wisdom passed down by this, by Simon Baker's character, who's this sort of layabout, who has, you know, really wise things to impart, but is also, you know, a kind of a man child, a boy who never grew up. And so it's a lovely film and a really, really good debut feature.
The Australian drama Breath is at Lemley's Monica Film Center, Santa Monica, and Lemley's Playhouse in Pasadena. Simon Baker, the director, co-screenwriter, and one of the stars of the film. It's unrated. Justin Chang, LA Times film critic with us. Christy Lemire of RogerEbert.com and co-host of YouTube's What the Flick. Next up, they'll tell us about Hearts Beat Loud, a drama starring Nick Offerman and Kiersey Clemons. Ted Danson's in the cast. Brett Haley directed and co-wrote it with Mark Bash. Christy?
This movie is totally charming. It's this lovely little gem, and it's about a summer in which Nick Offerman, who plays the owner of a record store in Red Hook, Brooklyn, is trying to enjoy the last moments he can with his daughter, Kiersey Clemons, who is a superstar, enormously charismatic, so talented. And the two of them have a shared love of music. And he kind of cajoled her into forming a band with him. As he used to be in a band, that's how he met Kiersey Clemons' late mom. And his love of music throughout this entire film. And he kind of wants to start a band, and she kind of thinks it's dorky, but they have a really great chemistry with each other, so she gives into it. The songs by Keegan DeWitt are so catchy, and they're so good. This reminded me a lot of The Best of John Carney. Like Once, like Begin Again, and not quite as great as Sing Street, but it has that same lovely kind of organic feel of creation and the transformative power of music. It's kind of nicey nice and kind of cute, but it charmed me.
It's charming, and it has that very kind of intimate, handcrafted feel to it. Brett Haley, the director, who's been quite prolific of late, you know, he directed I'll See You in My Dreams, which was that lovely dramedy starring Blythe Danner, who appears here in a role as Nick Offerman's mother. The rapport between Offerman and Clemons is really just what sells this movie, and it's they have this sort of, you know, prickly relationship that you bespeaks, you know, a very close father-daughter bond, where and it's like she is this, you know, bound for the pre-med at UCLA, and so she's getting ready to say goodbye to Red Hook and be out on her own, and he is going through this, you know, kind of classic male midlife crisis of, like, you know, having to sell off his record store and wanting to be in a band with his daughter, and he kind of keeps jabbing at her, kind of like, hey, let's have our jam session, and hey, let's get, it's like, she's like, Dad, I'm trying to study, and he's like, no, come look at through this old vinyl with me. It's really, and Offerman is just so good, too. I mean, he is just, no one is better at playing those types of, you know, semi-curmudgeonly characters who just are, but who you believe in his conviction and his love of this music yes. every step, too.
And Toni Collette is in this, but she's far less scary than she is in Hereditary.
We're talking about Hearts Beat Loud. I don't know if you'd call it a full-on musical, but a lot of music in the film, certainly. Nick Offerman, Kiersey Clemons, Ted Danson star, Brett Haley directed and co-wrote. It's rated PG-13. You can see it at the Landmark in West L.A. or the Arclight in Hollywood. The comedic drama Bernard and Huey, set in late 80s New York, David Koechner, Jim Rash and Mae Whitman star, Dan Mirvish, the director, and Jules Pfeiffer, the screenwriter. Christy?
So this is an old Jules Pfeiffer screenplay from the 80s, which has been updated to the present day. But some of the sensibilities in terms of its views of women and its celebration of toxic masculinity do feel rather dated and of their time. Dan Mirvish, who directed it, is one of the co-creators of the Slam Dance Film Festival at Sundance. And this is an actor's showcase in the best way that, you know, really solid indies can be. You have David Koechner and Jim Rash as friends who have not seen each other in 25 years. And we flash back to their youth when they were in college, and David Koechner's character was the ladies' man, and Jim Rash's character was kind of nebbishy and kind of insecure. And now those two roles have flipped now that they have reconnected. And it's what happens when they see each other after all this time. And there's a lot of talk about women in terms of their usefulness and their disposability. And that comes to a head when Jim Rash's character falls for Mae Whitman, who is Koechner's daughter in this. Jules Pfeiffer, of course, was a longtime Village Voice cartoonist. He also wrote the screenplay for Carnal Knowledge. So if you have seen that, you might have a sense of the kind of dialogue here. It crackles, it really does, but a lot of it is kind of cringe-inducing, too. Jim Rash, in particular, has a great facility with the rhythms and the energy of the writing. Again, I feel a little uneasy about it. It's entertaining, but just off tonally.
Bernard and Huey, the film, screenwriter Jules Pfeiffer, Dan Mirvish, the director, David Koechner, Jim Rash, Mae Whitman star. It's unrated, Lemley's Monica Film Center in Santa Monica. Alex Strangelove stars Daniel Doheny, Madeline Weinstein, and Antonio Marzial, written and directed by Craig Johnson. Justin, what'd you think?
This is a very sweet coming-of-age, coming-out high school sex comedy, basically. And we've seen, it's an interesting companion piece, I think, to Love, Simon, which came out a few weeks or months ago and was sort of a landmark in being the first studio-produced romantic comedy with a gay protagonist. This one is, this is a Netflix movie. It's a little, it's similar in scale and feel, but a little bit more mysterious and ambiguous in its treatment of the character's sexuality. He is Alex Truelove. The movie is titled Strange Love. It's a little Philip there. And he's played by Danny Doheny, who is with a girl, has a girlfriend, is pretty popular, student body president. And the movie makes some deal with the fact that he has not, and so do his friends, of the fact that he and his girlfriend, played by Madeline Weinstein, have not had sex yet. And the question becomes, why is that? He wants to, but there's something that is, she's not holding back, but he is for some reason. And, people ask, are you gay? Or is it, and he says no. It becomes this sort of, there's almost kind of a Greek chorus effect where he just like is talking to and meeting different people and talking about this problem with. And he is a very intelligent, a little neurotic guy with a real passion for marine biology and cephalopods. And so there's all these kinds of cute little quirks to it. And I liked the way, up to a point, I like the way that it sort of retains some ambiguity about what's going on with him. And it's a commentary on the fact that, he sort of gives voice at a certain point to the fact that everything is so polysexual now. Are you bisexual? There's so many kind of definitions of what it means to be an LGBTQ person now. And it engages with that in a pretty thoughtful and endearing way.
Well, it feels very of its time in that it doesn't want to put him in a box, and it right. follows him during his journey of exploration. And there's no judgment. There's no villain here. I mean, the tension comes from his own conflict within himself and his desire to understand himself. Madeline Weinstein is very good in
She's
this
so
too.
Good. Yeah.
She also was the girlfriend in Beach Rats, which is also about a high school kid who was closeted. Anyway, this is really sweet and very knowing as a John Hughes-esque kind of high school comedy drama. I liked it.
Alex Strangelove, the film written and directed by Craig Johnson. It's unrated at Lemley's NoHo Theater in North Hollywood, also streaming on Netflix. Coming up, we're going to talk with Buck Henry and Lawrence Terman. Buck Henry, the screenwriter of The Graduate. Lawrence Terman, the producer of the film, who bought the rights to the novel for $20,000, shepherded it all the way through production. The two men joined us on stage, along with our Film Week critic, Peter Rayner, and Beverly Gray, who wrote the book about the film and its cultural impact. All of them joined us on stage, and we're going to bring you an edited portion of that conversation coming right up. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. Our critics this week, Christy Lemire and Justin Chang. That's all to come right after this.
KBCC podcasts are supported by Freeform's The Bold Type, produced by Universal Television. Emmy eligible in all categories, including Outstanding Drama Series, and Freeform's Grown-ish, produced by ABC Signature Studios. Emmy eligible in all categories, including Outstanding Comedy Series, Outstanding Lead Actress in a Comedy Series for Yara Shahidi, and Outstanding Contemporary Costumes. Episodes available at Freeform.com, the Freeform app, and Hulu.
You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle. This past Saturday night, theater at Ace Hotel, our Film Week screening series presented Mike Nichols' 1967 classic, The Graduate. And after the show, we had a wonderful panel come up on stage to talk about the film, including our Film Week critic, Peter Rayner, author and entertainment journalist Beverly Gray, who wrote Seduced by Mrs. Robinson about the film's cultural significance. The producer of The Graduate, Larry Terman, was with us, and the man who wrote the screenplay, Buck Henry. I started by asking Buck what it was like for him to see the film 50 years later on the big screen and to get the kind of warm response it got from the audience.
I still respond to the films I loved the first time I saw them almost the same way today. So I hope that's what this is.
Yeah. Yeah, I think people respond to whether they're of the generation that they saw this film when it was new, or like me seeing it when it came on television, or others maybe seeing it for the first time. Larry, same question for you. What's it like for you seeing it with a crowd like this?
My answer will embarrass myself because I'll sound so ungracious. I thought it was damn good. I mean, Everyone was at the top of their game. I mean, Buck's screenplay is terrific. Mike hit every ball out of the ballpark.
Yeah.
We were lucky and smart about casting. I liked it.
Now, when you identified Mike Nichols as the director you wanted, at that point, he hadn't done a film, but he'd had successful Broadway productions. What convinced you that he'd be ready for a feature?
Mike, at the point I sent him the book of The Graduate, had done but a single play on Broadway, Barefoot in the Park, oozing wonderful direction. He, of course, had done his stand-up with Elaine, but he had done no other plays, no movies. I had a hunch. I sent him the book cold, and 2 days later I was in New York. I got a phone message that said, Mr. Nichols called you, said he likes the book.
And he ended up actually making Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf first, and when you saw the response to that and the critical acclaim, you must have thought, wow, that's very prescient.
No, oddly enough, the producer and writer of Virginia Woolf was a close friend of mine, Ernie Lehman, one of the preeminent screenwriters in Hollywood history. He did North by Northwest, Sabrina, all kinds of good movies. At any rate, he called me one day to say that Burton and Taylor were making lots of noises about Mike Nichols. What did I think of him? And I, in my Machiavellian mood, said, oh, great, let Mike get some experience on his first movie, then come to me. What I'd learned subsequently in my career is talent is talent first time out.
Beverly Gray, you were a senior at UCLA when this came out, right?
Sure was, so, yes.
Yeah, so how did this film speak to you when you saw it the first time?
What I think is really special about The Graduate is that everyone saw it a little differently. When I saw it, I wasn't thinking so much of sex with my father's business partner's wife, but I was sure thinking about graduating, going out into the world, and the fact that my parents had pretty much mapped out my entire future. The scenes at the beginning of the film at the party, that felt like home to me. That felt like my being moved into the bourgeois middle class by parents who were completely well-intentioned, But I, in that very complicated era, was just not certain that I wanted to be exactly who they wanted me to be. So the film really struck me as very personal at that point.
And give us a sense how the world responded to the film, critics, audiences, at the time it came out.
I think the people who made the film were astonished that young people just gravitated toward this film. It was as if there was something in the air. And what was so interesting about it was this was a very turbulent era, late 1967. Even though the film is not about the civil rights movement, it is not about the Vietnam War, young people were feeling all of those things. And they were feeling disaffiliated from their parents' generation. They were feeling uneasy about who they were supposed to be and what their country was telling them. And they all gravitated toward The Graduate as a film that, in its own way, without mentioning any of that stuff, made them feel that it understood them.
Peter, you know, watching the film 50 years later, I'm amazed that even as it is so much of its time and so captures the era, that it connects in the way it does today. And what are the aspects of the film that you think make it so durable?
Young people are always wondering what they're going to do with their lives. I mean, somewhat similar to Beverly, I think, you know, I saw the film when I was in 10th grade when it first opened, so that's a while ago. It's true that the movie means different things to you in different ages. So when I see it now, the Benjamin Mrs. Robinson affair is much more pertinent. I don't mean this personally, but I mean it has more resonance for me as a, you know, an adult. When I was in 10th grade, that was just sort of titillating. Even the innocent romance with Catherine Ross was not quite where I was at yet. What did strike home for me was what you were saying, that I was absolutely terrified of going out into the world, even on my way into college. You know, what am I going to do? I came from a family of you know, doctors and lawyers. They were very accommodating. They loved movies. So it wasn't, you know, like, you've got to do this. But I did feel, you know, somewhat adrift from that world. And so this film spoke to me in a very real way. And also, I think the casting of Dustin Hoffman was so unusual. I think there's an anecdote, forgive me if it's not true, so many aren't, but Mike Nichols had directed Redford on Broadway prior to this, and Redford was sort of interested in playing Benjamin. Mike Nichols said, well, I don't think you're right for it. He says, well, what do you mean? He says, well, have you ever been, you know, shot down by a woman? And Redford says, well, what do you mean? And Mike Nichols said, I rest my case.
Larry.
I'll tell you from the horse's mouth. Yeah. Mike Nichols, I also happen to have known Redford early on from the first short film he made, a documentary, The Friends of Mine. And Mike, of course, had a fabulous experience with him on Broadway. So Mike suggested Bob Redford to me. And I said, I love Redford, I know him, but I don't think he's right for the role. So Mike Nichols then said, well, let me think about that. Next day he said to me, come to my house for dinner tonight. I said, sure, Mike. So I went to his house for dinner, and who's there? Bob Redford. And Mike, in his own inimitable way, and Buck knows him even better than I, but knows this is really a Mike story, Mike, in front of Redford, turns to me and says, Larry, tell me why you don't want Bob in this movie. True story. So I said what I said, and he said, would you test him? I said, absolutely. I'd love to. I want to be wrong. I admire him, so I want to be wrong. Let's test him. So we tested Mike with Candy Bergen, Dusty with Catherine, the now director Tony Bill, tested at the time as an actor. Chuck Grodin, who gave a wonderful reading, was tested, and some fifth person whose name eludes me. So tested them. 2 days later, Mike and I are the two of us alone in a projection room watching the tests. And Redford's test comes on with candy, and what you see, of course, is a wonderfully talented, skillful actor doing everything right. But the test wasn't even halfway through, and Mike turned to me and he said, "Terman, you son of a bitch, you're right."
You're listening to The Conversation from last Saturday night, the theater at Ace Hotel, after our Film Week screening of The Graduate. We have more to come in just 1 minute. Great to have you with us for Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. In case you just joined us, we are replaying our post-screening conversation from the theater at Ace Hotel last Saturday night after we showed the comedy classic The Graduate. Joining me on stage were our Film Week critic Peter Rayner, the author of Seduced by Mrs. Robinson, Beverly Gray, The Graduate's producer, the man who shepherded it all the way, Larry Terman, and the screenwriter of the film, Oscar-nominated Buck Henry. In this next portion of our conversation, I asked Buck Henry how he came up with one of the film's most memorable lines.
Plastics. Where did that idea come from?
Well, it didn't come from anywhere. I mean, it was just there. There are millions of words. I could have picked any other. But it just was like something I'd heard in my own life, as all of it is. And once I said it in my head, there was no place else I went to that could improve, I thought. And so there it was. And also the first readings of it were so good that, I mean, the character actors in the movie are so terrific.
Yeah.
Yeah, so true.
Well, and plastics is the single most memorable line in the entire movie.
How did the plastics industry develop after this film?
Very rapidly.
I can answer that. There was an article in Time magazine, maybe it was the 25th or the 30th anniversary of the film, and some enterprising reporter actually went to a convention of plastics manufacturers, and they all talked about how they really appreciated the film. Some of them said, "We entered the business because it sounded very promising to us."
See, I thought that the Carl, the doctor, was going to go into plastic surgery at least. So,
of course,
you know, I wanted to just
In the
Robert Altman movie, The Player, the very long tracking shot in the beginning has you pitching a sequel to The Graduate. Was there ever any thought of that?
Endlessly. People were always coming up with ideas to make a Graduate 2 even better than Graduate 1. I tried to negotiate for a Graduate 1.5 with a producer that I didn't like much. So it never went anywhere, thank God. All the time, from the moment it came out, there were people talking about a sequel.
Because in The Player, the pitch that you make is that, you know, Benjamin and they're married, and Mrs. Robinson is by herself and moves in with them.
Was that really the story idea you had for 1.5?
No. But the really odd thing is, and not a lot of people know this, but the author of the book, The Graduate, has written a sequel. And he sent the first two chapters to me a year or so ago, because I couldn't understand why nobody had published it here. He said he was just having problems. Nobody wanted to do it.
Did you have in your mind the story arc for where this story would go in the next chapter?
Good God, no. Sequels usually serve to wreck your memory of the original.
Well said.
However, the infinitely more interesting stuff about this is that, so he sent me these two chapters and I read them, and now I'm going to reveal to an audience for the first time what happens to the three of them. Ben and Elaine have been married for quite a while. They have one or two kids, and Mrs. Robinson comes to visit them. They live up further north, California.
East Coast.
Where?
East Coast.
Oh, they're on
the
East?
Yeah, they moved to the East Coast, yeah.
How do you know that?
Because I've read it. The sequel is available, but I do not particularly recommend it.
It is? What's it called?
Pardon me?
What's it called?
Homeschool, and it's basically about homeschooling. Mrs. Robinson is imported to seduce the head of the school board.
Which she does.
Right. So that Ben and Elaine can homeschool their children, which was illegal at the time. It's a strange sequel.
Your next film, Larry.
I think Marvel is interested in this.
So you think a sequel would have been a mistake and would have ruined this, clearly.
It would have wrecked all our lives. You'd be sitting here on an empty stage.
No one would.
Talking about what killed Nichols, Henry, and Terman.
What was it like for you working with Mike Nichols? What was your working relationship like?
Like two very close friends who are, together working something out. I mean, it's all puzzle solving to me.
Larry, can you describe what the working relationship was with the three of you?
Well, in fairness, Mike did 90% of the work with Buck on the script. I did 100% of the work on the script with Calder Willingham, the first writer.
Did the first draft of it.
Who undeservedly, because of your guild, gets credit in first position among the writers because this ties into Mike and myself being so congruent, well, that's me, Benjamin Braddock. I imposed on Calder Willingham the structure of the book. So many scenes in the same order from the book, very different tone, which is Buck's fine hand. And the Writers Guild, in assessing who deserves credit, saw the first writer's script called Willingham, beginning with the party going to, you're trying to seduce me straight through, so they gave him credit. Buck never saw his script, had nothing to do with it, and frankly, everyone who's on the inside in Hollywood knew it was totally Buck's script. But I'm doing so much talking, I forgot your question. There was a handful of brief periods where Mike was busy and I spent some time with Buck on the script. But in fairness, I can take no credit for anything specific other than really imposing. That book spoke to me, even though, the book was unsuccessful, but there's something about
It was successful
me,
after the movie.
The book reminded me of the work of Harold Pinter, the talented, famous British writer, in that the book itself made me laugh but made me nervous. And I think the film has it in a much even better degree because the laughs are more obvious here, because of talented writing and Mike's also great skill.
And great acting. We haven't mentioned, of course, Anne Bancroft. An incredible performance.
Agreed.
So much just facially that she conveys.
And in the performance. Interesting, Dustin was just turning 30 at the time, and Annie was 35, and they played that so well.
You've been listening to our post-screening conversation from last Saturday night, theater at Ace Hotel downtown, after we showed the comedy classic The Graduate. Film Week critic Peter Rayner with us, Beverly Gray, author of Seduced by Mrs. Robinson, the producer of the film Larry Terman, and its screenwriter Buck Henry. I hope you'll join us for our next Film Week screening series at the Ace coming up in August. It's Larry Mantle. Have a wonderful weekend from all of us at Film Week. Thanks so much for joining us.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win, and the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.